Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past 5 months, the Syrian city of Madaya has been besieged by forces loyal to the Syrian government. The government allowed aid into Madaya after images of emaciated children and residents surviving on grass and tree leaves received widespread condemnation. Marianne Gasser, head of the International Committee for the Red Cross, told today's guest, reporter Karim Shaheen, quote, "People are desperate. Food is in extremely short supply. It is the elderly, women, and children who are suffering the most, especially from severe malnourishment. The conditions are some of the worst that I have witnessed in my 5 years in the country. This cannot go on," end quote. Also, she said she talked to a man who she met a couple of days ago in really bad condition. When he heard that flour will come to Madaya, he started crying. Children have started smiling and are more lively. Joining us to talk about media coverage of what is happening in Madaya and other parts of Syria where people have been deprived of basic necessities is Karim Shaheen. He is Middle East reporter for The Guardian, and he is based in Beirut. Hi, Karim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. We're going to talk about Madaya in just a couple minutes, but as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism of the week because there's a lot out there that doesn't always get a lot of attention. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, honestly, I have to say the international response to the Madaya coverage. I think there was a lot of international media coverage of the crisis, and as we saw, I mean, the international attention to it seems to have played a role, at least in pushing the Syrian government towards allowing aid into the city and potentially saving lots of people from starvation.
Can you tell us how this happened? I mean, how did the photos get out, and then talk a little bit about why and when the Syrian government had to respond.
Well, I mean, over the last few weeks, I mean, there have been people who are based in the city have been trying to get the word out about what's going on inside and about the starvation that's been going on, and people got in touch with us. They got in touch with other international media outlets, and we tried our best to verify their claims, and then as a consequence, we began reporting on it. Of course, the issue of sieges is not really a new thing in Syria. We've seen its use as a weapon of war for the past couple of years in the conflict in various areas that the Syrian regime considers strategically important. We were keen on trying to verify the facts of what's going on and trying to really understand the plight of the individual people. It's quite amazing when if you spoke to any of the residents of Madaya, just before the aid deliveries were allowed in. You could actually, hear it in their voices. You could hear the weakness from months without, being full, without having a proper breakfast. You could actually hear it in their tones, and it's something extraordinary that I've personally never witnessed before.
So Madaya is about an hour from Damascus. It's a population of 42,000 people. 17,600 are internally displaced. You interviewed residents of Madaya by phone. How difficult is it to reach them and to find them?
It's quite difficult. I actually asked them, how they were able to, use the internet in order to reach me. There's very little electricity. I mean, even if you talk to, the aid officials who went to the town to distribute aid, when the first thing you ask them, what do you see? And they'll tell you, well, it's really, really dark because there's no electricity, some of the people that I spoke to were actually, able to charge their phones for, a couple of hours every night because they would essentially try and steal some electricity from a neighboring village that's regime controlled. So they would go rather perilously close to a government checkpoint and tap into the electrical grid in the nearby town, and that way they'd be able to charge their phones and reach out to people outside the town.
What strikes you about the other reporting that you have seen? Because this issue is getting widespread attention. The Huffington Post has a piece, Serious Hunger Crisis Goes Beyond Madaya. They report that 4.5 million people within Syria and regions are very hard to reach for aid groups. 400,000 live in besieged areas. This is according to the United Nations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the United Nations figure is actually, you know, an underestimation because groups like MSF, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières, the international, you know, Doctors Without Borders, they estimate that actually millions live under hard, you know, in besieged areas in Syria. This has unfortunately been a tactic that's been used, you know, throughout the war by the Syrian government primarily. Some of the areas are, of course, besieged by rebels, but they're a very small minority compared to the areas that are besieged by the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. There are, you know, places like the Yarmouk refugee camp, which is in southern Damascus, was under siege for about 3 years, you know, with very basic necessities like food that are, you know, denied to the residents there. And ultimately, the power vacuum led to ISIS actually, you know, invading the area earlier in 2015, and they were able to take control of much of Yarmouk because of the absence of any, you know, organized opposition to them as a consequence of the siege. So this has been a tactic that's been used for a really long time in the Syrian war. And the aim of it is basically to make, you know, residents hate the rebels that are, you know, that have taken over in those areas, you know, try and turn the population against the rebels, try and reach some sort of agreement in order to evacuate them so that the government can reestablish control over areas that it considers, you know, strategically important. And as a result, we've seen this use of starvation tactics that the UN Secretary General has called a war crime. In areas, especially in the countryside around Damascus.
Now, again, you spoke with residents of Madaya by phone. When you interview them, what do they tell you about their response to these tactics?
It's really, really heartbreaking. I mean, you know, today I was talking to one man who lives in Madaya who, you know, was speaking about the there was an aid delivery yesterday that brought in wheat flour. And as a result of that, you know, he was saying that, you know, we haven't seen the shape of bread, you know, the taste of bread, the smell of bread in a really long time. And we had almost forgotten it. You know, the first time the aid deliveries went in on Monday, you know, a big part of it was, you know, green beans and rice. And he was telling me about their first, you know, breakfast in about 3 or 4 months, you know, and he said that all of Madaya that day was having green beans and rice for lunch because that was, you know, all they had. He was describing how they decided that they were going to be full, that they were going to try and be full that day because it was the first time in 3 or 4 months that they had had, you know, enough food for proper breakfast. He was talking about how they, for the first time, were able to actually put sugar in tea. You know that having tea with sugar in it was an impossibility, you know, just days before. And when I spoke to them before the, you know, I spoke to several residents before the aid actually came in, and they were describing really, really heartbreaking scenes. You know, doctors were talking about you know, babies not having baby milk. They would have to give the babies and young children sugar serums directly, you know, fed directly into their mouths because, you know, just to keep them alive. And there are lots of minefields around the town. You know, the area was mined in order to prevent people from trying to leave. And they were talking about how children would, you know, go to try and collect grass in order to be able to cook it, about people cooking tree leaves, but even that was in short supply because it's winter and the area is mountainous, and so the snow has covered a lot of the trees, and even the tree leaves that they used to cook to feed themselves, you know, were in short supply. One particular staple food was water flavored with spices because they didn't really have the ingredients to make any soup, and as a consequence would instead have to eat boiled water with spices mixed in instead of soup.
We're speaking today with Karim Shaheen. He's the Middle East reporter for The Guardian based in Beirut. He's been covering what has been happening in Madaya. For the past 5 months, the city of Madaya has been besieged by forces loyal to the Syrian government. After horrific images got out to the world, the government allowed aid into Madaya. We saw photos of emaciated children, residents surviving on grass and tree leaves, and this has obviously received widespread condemnation. And if you'd like to join us, Karim will be with us for about 10 more minutes. If you have any questions about what is happening in Syria and what it is like for a reporter who cannot get into Syria and has to rely on phone interviews. We've interviewed a lot of people in the Middle East who have no choice but to rely on Skype conversations, social media, phone conversations to get information out of Syria. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. This is getting a lot of attention in the media. What do you think about the coverage of this issue? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Karim, I'm still trying to understand why the Syrian government is doing this. And as a reporter who has no choice but to report outside of Syria, how do you get answers to that question?
Well, I think, I mean, the Syrian government's aim is quite clear. I mean, they've used this tactic in various areas, beyond Madaya, and there are still places that are under siege today, you know, by both the Syrian regime, by rebels, by ISIS, but primarily by the Syrian regime. And the aim is generally in order to, regain control over strategic areas that they feel are too close to their, key strongholds and that are of particular strategic interest. And the aim of it is basically to, starve the town to the extent that they turn against the rebels that are, that may be in the town, even though in most of these areas, the rebels really number 1 in 10 of the people who are in those towns. And so overwhelmingly, the people who are affected by these sieges are civilians, women and children, people who are, unable to fend for themselves. And they succeeded, in various areas around the country. They've succeeded in negotiating ceasefires where, the rebels are evacuated to other areas that are under rebel control, and the government regains control of those areas and removes the threat from the location that they consider strategic for them. And in addition to that, the prices of food items skyrockets. For example, in Madaya, the price of a kilogram of rice was the Syrian equivalent of about $250. Mm. So basically, the theory is that some of the people who, allow some of these food products to come into the town, benefit financially, and these are usually people who are manning government checkpoints around the town.
And what about the Syrian government's decision to allow aid convoys to get in? What role do you think the media and social media played in forcing the regime to do that?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, obviously there are peace talks that are scheduled for later in January in Vienna. That are intended to attempt to bring together the government and the opposition and the different actors playing a role in the Syrian crisis and in the peace negotiations. So it might be a sort of fig leaf. I don't know what the thinking of the government is exactly when it comes to the coverage of something like Madaya, but surely the international attention that's been focused on it has not been flattering, has been problematic. I mean, here in Lebanon, Hezbollah, which is, playing a role in the siege and is an ally of the Syrian government, has issued repeated statements trying to deny, the stories coming out of Madaya, the news of malnutrition among children, the fact that there is a siege at all, and claiming that, armed groups that are in the town are the ones who are holding the town hostage. And so they've made a conscious effort to try and rebut some of the public relations issues that have emerged out of the Madaya coverage, and so clearly the media attention has played a role in ameliorating the situation a little bit, But it's really difficult to guess exactly what the Syrian government is thinking. But its allies have certainly, shown extraordinary sensitivity to the bad press that's emerged out of this.
Hezbollah has said that the images are fake.
Yeah, they I mean, we got an email today from Hezbollah's public relations, explaining how, rebutting some of the images and saying that they weren't really images of starving children in Madaya. They've also said that there's some 600 gunmen in the town who are actually holding the town hostage. They've said that these gunmen are the ones who are preventing aid from reaching civilians. They've said that they've managed to evacuate some of the civilians and that they weren't preventing people from leaving. They've said a lot of things that they're hoping obviously to burnish their image because they're considered a resistance organization, a revolutionary organization that they're very conscious of the fact that they don't want to be seen as preying on the poor and hungry, and so they've made a conscious effort to try and rebut some of these arguments.
Is this getting much attention in Lebanon?
Yeah,
in the media.
Lebanon is an extremely dysfunctional place when it comes to government, and so like every single issue, like the Syrian crisis overall, like many other political issues in the country, it's polarized public opinion. There were obviously the opponents of Hezbollah are seizing on the issue as an indication that the party has really forgotten its roots, of resistance to Israel and trying to liberate Lebanese land and Arab land from Israel's occupation, and they find it really ironic that the party that claims to defend the weak and is engaging in essentially starvation tactics. Obviously, Hezbollah and its and the media that backs it has spent considerable amount of time trying to rebut the stories that are coming out of Madaya and the reporting that's emerged over the past couple of weeks. It's quite polarizing, but there have also been some voices sensibly from within Hezbollah's traditional base that are saying this is not right. We shouldn't be a part of something so brutal and something so inhumane. And it really came to a head over the last weekend when a number of people were, in Lebanon who are supporters of Hezbollah were tweeting, images of their, they tweeted a hashtag that translated into "I stand with Madaya," tweeting images of their dinners and images of, the food that they have in the fridge. It's a way of mocking, both the people of Madaya and the coverage of the crisis. So it's really polarized opinion here, like most issues related to Hezbollah tend to do.
And before we let you go, where do you see this going? I mean, what are your thoughts about diplomatic efforts? What should be done to end this siege? What do you think will be done to end this?
Well, look, I mean, Madaya is not an exception. Madaya is just one out of many other Syrian towns. I think over 30 locations that are actually under long-term siege. It's a tactic that's been used, it's a medieval tactic that's been used throughout this war, primarily by the Syrian government, and without concerted pressure on the Syrian government and by its own backers, this is going to continue as a weapon of war. I mean, there are currently negotiations that, their goal is to enforce a countrywide ceasefire within 6 months, and the Syrian government is likely to intensify the use of these tactics in order to gain as much advantage and to be able to control as much strategic land as possible in the run-up to the ceasefire. And so the world's attention must not be diverted, from just because the aid has entered Madaya, the aid will last them for a month. After a month, they're going to be starving again. And Madaya is not an exception. It's actually quite typical of the starvation siege tactics that have been used throughout the Syrian conflict over the last 3 years. And if worldwide attention was only really focused on it when there was reporting and when it reached the crisis point, you know, people were already dying of starvation. There were Doctors Without Borders reported upwards of 20 cases that had died in the last couple of months out of starvation. And that shouldn't be happening in the 21st century. You know, it's people should not be dying of hunger. And that's what people inside Syria will tell you. You know, we thought that nobody could ever die from hunger, but we were wrong. We actually saw people dying from hunger. And so basically people really should not, divert their attention away from these crises, because Madaya is just one out of, 400,000 by the UN count, and millions by other independent estimates who are starving to death in Syria.
Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter with The Guardian based in Beirut. He is covering what's happening on the ground in Syria. Karim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And after a quick break, we will talk about coverage of Sean Penn's interview with Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. It's receiving widespread attention and criticism from Mexican journalists who cover this issue. We'll talk about coverage of the drug war in Mexico and the war on drugs in the U.S. with veteran journalist Sam Quiñones. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, telephone us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the website yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation with Leif Wanar about his new book, Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. In spite of major progress and the Leave It in the Ground movement, we are still connected to suffering and injustice through our addiction to oil. So what are the global consequences of our reliance on natural resources? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to talk about Sean Penn's interview with Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. It's receiving widespread media coverage and criticism from Mexican journalists and those who cover Mexico and the drug war. Sean Penn met with El Chapo in the jungle in October when the drug lord was still a fugitive. Alfredo Cochardo, former Mexico bureau chief with the Dallas Morning News, took to Twitter to say that Sean Penn's meeting and interview was an epic insult to journalists who have died in the name of truth. So joining us to talk about this interview and how the media are covering the drug war in Mexico and the so-called drug war on drugs in the U.S. is Sam Quiñones. Sam is an award-winning journalist and former L.A. Times reporter. He covered immigration, drug trafficking, and gangs. Sam is the author of three books, including his most recent, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. So I wonder what your thoughts are on the attention that Sean Penn's interview got after we learned that in Rolling Stone, he secretly met with El Chapo deep in the jungle in October. And as I said, Alfredo Cochardo, former Mexico bureau chief with the Dallas Morning News, ripped Sean Penn, basically saying that it was an epic insult to journalists who've died in the name of truth. And according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 60 Mexican journalists have been killed or have been disappeared over the past decade. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly agree with Alfredo that what's really sad is that there are so many people. Alfredo's one of them, by the way. Certainly one at the top of the list who have spent so much time and love, really, for Mexico and for this topic, and have devoted themselves to understanding it, learning the nuances. It's a very complicated topic. Does not lend itself to easy formulation is the way I think Sean Penn would like to think. And there are so many people who have done so much to very bravely to cover this topic. And I did feel, it felt like an insult, but I have to tell you, it also felt very frivolous. Like this was a guy who was kind of bored with acting or something, and well, now he's going to go and be the gonzo journalist in the jungles of northern Sinaloa, is where I understand this thing took place. To my way of thinking, it's first of all, it's a wasted opportunity. I was not aware that of any deep preparation Sean Penn had done for this. Had he studied the history of Chapo Guzman? Had he studied the real disastrous, catastrophic effect that this man has had on the country of Mexico? Would he know when Chapo Guzman says in that kind of videotaped interview that he sent later that I don't cause trouble, I just defend myself from others creating problems, I don't do that. That is a lie on the order of magnitude. It's impossible to exaggerate how much of a lie that is. Mexico's great tragedy, this is the great tragedy of Mexico in the last 15 years, since they very bravely as a country voted out, without one bullet being fired, voted out a party that had been 70 years in power, run it basically like a one-party state. Just at the moment when Mexico was kind of fumbling for new ways of governing itself, a democratic, more plural, more inclusive way, this guy escapes from prison, and beginning in 2000, in 2001, and then in 2003 and 4, really, 2004, he makes the first foray that ignites this drug war that we've seen for the last, since then. He sends his soldiers to the Texas side, to the Mexico border near Texas, because the Gulf Cartel, which runs things over there, has had its leader arrested, and he feels they're vulnerable. So he goes, and it got repelled. Each major battle that we have seen in this war was really fundamentally was started by Chapo Guzman. The Juarez became the world's most dangerous place because the Sinaloa cartel, Chapo thought that he could go and take a portion of Juarez, which eventually, my understanding is, he did, but at the cost of thousands of people dying every year. The war in Tijuana that took place in 2008, 9, and 10 was largely because he wanted that territory too. That was a part that would belong to his arch rivals, the Arellano Felix cartel, and he kind of convinces factions within that cartel to bolt and to join him, and that sends Tijuana into kind of medieval savagery for several years. So what bothered me, there's a number of things bothered me about this. Well, I will admit to being extraordinarily jealous. I wish I were there in the jungle with him. I'd have a million questions for the guy. It also felt to me like this was frivolous, like there was not preparation, there was not the commitment that many other journalists who have studied Mexico, have written about Mexico, who spent the time in the country have put in. Like he kind of could just felt like, well, I just waltz in and see what the big guy has to say, and then end up kind of being enamored with him, like a little puppy love kind of thing. That all of that kind of combined to make me feel, ugh, it was kind of, you know, unclean after reading it, honestly. Mm.
Well, so it's getting so much attention, and Alfredo Corchado was interviewed by NPR after he sent out all of these tweets. The Washington Post also had a really good story, why Sean Penn's El Chapo meeting was an epic insult to imperiled Mexican journalists. And Hildebrando de Yonder Ayala, editor-in-chief of El Mañana, one of the oldest and largest newspapers in the region, with a circulation of 30,000, told Dana Priest that he had been shot, kidnapped, his home has been set on fire. And he said it's really important for people to understand that the cartel demands self-censorship. He said, you do it or you die. Nobody wants to die, and so self-censorship is our shield. Do you think the media have done a good enough job of really taking what Sean Penn did and then writing stories about what journalists actually face on a daily basis there?
I'm not sure if in reaction to the Sean Penn interview that has happened. I actually haven't followed it as deeply. But I will say that I do think that there have been pretty good stories over a period of years now about the dangers facing journalists. The problem is it doesn't seem to help very much. I mean, in Juarez at one point, an editor, I believe it was of the audio up there, said, you know, wrote an editorial to the narcos saying, what is it you want us to do? Because his people have been killed, have been terrorized for several years by that point. And it was like this cry of desperation. Tell us what you want us to do. Yes, in many areas, these cartels behave like governments. I don't believe they have a political bone in their bodies, but they understand the importance of running things and being kind of stepping in where the vacuum of the Mexican government exists. And so I do believe that in the past this kind of stuff has been written about very exhaustively, and I think and well, although probably anything you write does not do justice to the pure crystalline terror that my colleagues down in like Veracruz or in Tamaulipas or parts of Tijuana or Mexicali or where have you, Sinaloa certainly, must live with every day. I mean, it must be something that affects you physically, and I'm not sure anything that's come out so far really approaches that. The thing, Sean, again, my reaction was that this is an unserious person to the Sean Penn interview, that this was an unserious person reading too much Hunter S. Thompson, who decided that he had the leverage to be able to pull this off, which he did, not to very great effect, I think. And again, I'm jealous. I would professionally, I'll easily admit it. But to me, it felt like this was a kind of frivolity born of the lack of awareness, a lack of knowledge of what the reality actually is on the ground for reporters, for business people, for anybody who has to live in a territory where a cartel controls, or God forbid, that a cartel, that two cartels are battling over. It seemed to me, thin is goes without saying, but kind of frivolous, as if I guess I'm going to go do this now, and then the fact that he didn't speak Spanish. To me, I think if Sean Penn is going to go around interviewing Hugo Chavez and El Chapo Guzman, he better learn Spanish from now on, for God's sake. I mean, if that's what he's going to be doing with his career, he better start learning some Spanish, because it's clear he doesn't have a clue when he's down there, and he's being told what people have said. You know, it's interesting. I saw Mystic River last night. I watched Mystic River last night, which includes Clint Eastwood from 2003. Fantastic movie about working class Boston, and there you get. I mean, I was watching that going, now look, this is one of our finest actors. This guy is such a great actor in that movie. It made me feel. I wrote this on Facebook earlier. When I watched Michael Jordan play baseball. You knew it was like Sean Penn doing journalism is like watching Michael Jordan play baseball. You know that there's something superior that they could be doing, and very seriously, and in a dominant way, and yet they're kind of frivolously wasting or spending their time on little nonsense like this.
Also, just quickly, Sam, the piece had to be submitted for approval before it was made public by El Chapo.
Yes, and that, I don't know that that's the biggest sin. That has frequently pieces or sections of pieces are submitted for fact-checking purposes. It's unclear to me that was the biggest sin of this whole issue. My feeling really is that there are so many people out there who've given blood, sweat, and tears to this, to understanding Mexico, to understanding the drug trade, and this, it does feel very insulting. The folks who've really been serious reporters, serious journalists, putting in the time to understand it all, and I think that whether or not someone has final review of a story, it depends on the conditions. Apparently, Chapo didn't have any problem with it, but my feeling is that it's not that's not best practices by any means, but it's also has been done before, certainly not the first time.
Sam Quiñones is an award-winning journalist and former LA Times reporter covering immigration, drug trafficking, and gangs. He's the author of three books, including his most recent, Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any thoughts, what were your reactions to this Sean Penn interview? And because of the focus on this interview and El Chapo, what are your thoughts on reporters in interviewing people about journalists who have lost their lives in Mexico, the drug war in Mexico, and then the so-called war on drugs in the United States? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Sam, what are your thoughts about reporting on El Chapo and who he is? According to various reports, under his direction, the Sinaloa cartel controlled 30% of the United States heroin market, worth between $3 and $4 billion annually.
Yeah, I would say 30% is probably low. I mean, I don't know. These are ballpark guesstimates by analysts at the DEA. I'm quite sure. I don't know how else you would make that decision, but I mean, look, all drugs come from Mexico now, with the exception of synthetic drugs and locally grown marijuana in the United States from Mendocino County and places like that. All drugs come from Mexico or come through Mexico. That's what the new era is about. Lots and lots of marijuana, a huge amounts of our methamphetamine, cocaine comes through Mexico from Bolivia and Colombia primarily, but it has to go through Mexico now. It doesn't. The Colombians relinquished control of it to the Mexicans, and of course, heroin grows the poppy grows very nicely in northwest Mexico along the Pacific coast, from Durango and Chihuahua and Sinaloa down to Guerrero and Michoacán, and so there's been a long history of processing there. I'm not sure how much they would be worth, but yeah, I mean, billions of dollars would not surprise me. One problem, of course, is that this is a very public entity that is not public at all. It's shrouded completely in secrecy, so you have no real knowledge of how it actually works. My feeling for a long time has been kind of contrary to that, which is that when Mexican drug trafficking crosses the border, it diffuses, and that is to say that there is not one large group controlling things or even a few fairly large groups controlling things. On the contrary, the reason it's so difficult to combat is because it diffuses, it atomizes into tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, little groups, little organizations, family-based things, and all across the country, because the market itself is so vast. In Mexico, it's a very oligopolistic industry, very much like the Mexican economy itself, honestly. And when it gets here, it tends to fragment into small groups, none of whom are doing billions of dollars of business, even hundreds of billions of dollars of business. But and they frequently get taken down by authorities, and our federal prison system is ample proof of that, I would say. But the coverage of the guy is, you know, there's one great book, The Last Narco, by Malcolm Beath that talks about this guy's life. I don't know that there's a whole lot more. There probably is a book or two that I've missed, but covering a guy who is extraordinarily public, has an enormous public effect, and yet there's very little documentation about him. You don't even know how old he is, really. All of that is you know, that's just the nature of the beast, I guess.
What about, just briefly, the history of El Chapo? We'll talk about the heroin epidemic here in the U.S. in a minute, but what else do we need to know about the history of El Chapo? Your former paper, yeah, the LA Times, has done some really good reporting on this.
He is, he's from one of the great stories in the drug world, if you ask me, is how a group of hillbillies from one part of Mexico, the county of Badiraguato, which is up in the Sinaloa Hills, grew, expanded from the 60s on into the 70s, 80s, and then, of course, up to recently, to control most of the border. Chapo's from there. The guys from the Juarez cartel were connected to that area. Many, many narcos have come out of this one county, Badiraguato. And it's famous, it's infamous across Mexico, this county, because of that. But he comes from a small, you know, town, Batuna, in Badiraguato, in a little village, a little rancho or something like that, and grows into this mega villain. I think that story, though, is in that story of those guys from that county is intimately connected to the Mexican government. The Mexican government, you can safely say, from the 70s into the 80s and certainly part of the 90s, was the world's largest drug trafficker. They were the ones who, elements of the Mexican government controlled and facilitated the expansion of these guys, set them up so they wouldn't cause problems in Mexico as much, and set them up with routes. The famous plazas, you know, they have the Tijuana route. Tijuana, Mexicali, you have the Arizona, you have Juarez, and you have the lower Rio Grande Valley by Texas, by the Gulf of Mexico. That was essentially set up by guys from the Mexican government, corralling and controlling and reining in these wild hillbilly traffickers who were the first ones to get going. And he grows out of that, and his rise is directly connected, I would say, and thanks to the control of the Mexican government for many years. They have allowed this. Certainly, the one party state that was in power basically allowed these guys to grow large, and of course profited from their growth.
And Sam, the LA Times reports that his fall would probably lead to a bloody turf war, and it'll do little to interrupt the broad market forces that define the worldwide drug market and Mexico's key role in it. Also, the LA Times reports that his children are poised to take over for him. So does his arrest, will it change much?
Yeah, that's a very good point, and it's a complicated answer, but Let me offer an alternative idea. Not that I don't agree with what you just said, but there's other things to take into consideration. People rise in drug cartels, I've come to believe, because they possess certain talents. And those talents are not easily replaceable. It's the same with any organization, but within drug trafficking cartels, it's especially necessary. Obviously, murder is one talent. But being a drug trafficker is very much being president of Federal Express. It's a logistics business. You got to find ways of getting a packet from here to there, and along the way, it's got to go through different hands. It's got to go deal with people who are not trustworthy, who have no legal connection to the law or anything like that, and also then people who are criminals themselves, and so. The person who can do that is actually a rare person. So a fantastic example of that is the Arellano Felix cartel that controlled Tijuana for many years. Bloodthirsty fellows, the brothers, the Arellano Felix brothers from Sinaloa, but they controlled the Tijuana area, in the Mexicali area. Key to their cartel, I believe, were actually two other brothers who were not part of their family, Gilberto and Ismael Higuera. And these two guys ran Mexicali and Tijuana. Ismael Higuera ran Tijuana for many years. This guy was a logistics magician. He was very good at his job. He was also very quick to murder. But he was very good at his job. And when the end of that cartel, I think, you can pinpoint from the time that the Higuera brothers were taken down, because the Arellano Felix never really were able to replace them. These guys were able to get tons and tons of drugs across the most heavily armed, one of the most heavily guarded borders in the world every year. And that is not a talent you can replace very easily. I doubt very strongly whether Chapo's sons are going to be at all a replacement for him. Most likely, if there's a good alternative, it will be somebody who is not related to him. I don't believe the sons are ever quite what the dad was. So I just don't. I mean, that's true in business of all kinds. But I definitely don't think that I think these guys have had it far too easy, and I do not believe that they'll be the real replacements. But I will say that I don't think it's a frivolous thing to go around pursuing people like this, because frequently what does happen is that they have brought talents that are not very easy to find and displayed them. And I think the Ariana Felix cartel is a perfect example. That cartel basically doesn't exist anymore. It does not exist anymore, though it's run kind of in a shadow of its former self down in Tijuana, but largely began with the demise of the two brothers. And then from there, the Ariana Felix brothers all met their demise. One was killed. Several more ended up in prison in the United States. And so I'm offering, not to say that that's not true what you just said, but I'm offering kind of another way of thinking about this that is a little more nuanced, mm-hmm. because this is an extraordinarily complicated topic, and unlike Sean Penn, I'm not given to easy formulations about what it's all about.
Well, I'd love to do an entire show about this, because it's just so fascinating when you just follow the line of the heroin and how it's possible that so much continues to get into the U.S. Now, your latest book, Sam's Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, is about what is happening in the U.S., and it has since gotten so much media attention. The New York Times had this incredible video series on what's happening. 44,000 Americans, 120 a day, now die of drug overdoses. The New York Times piece got a lot of attention because they reported that the crisis is different from its predecessors. The heroin epidemic has settled not so much in large cities as in suburbs and rural America. New users are mostly white. And yeah. That got a lot of attention because people in the piece said, you know, we need rehabilitation, we need programs to help these people. And the black community said, yeah, we've been saying that for decades. What are your thoughts about how the reporting has changed because this epidemic is now hitting mostly white people?
Well, you know, I started my reporting career during the crack years, and I remember far more attention given to the crack epidemic, by quite a bit. I mean, it's taken this problem with heroin and opiate painkillers, Vicodin and Percocet and Oxycontin has been around for 15 years now, and it's only in the last couple of years. I frankly think it a little bit only since my book came out, honestly, that has been getting the kind of attention that it really deserves. But I remember when I was living in Stockton, California. I was a crime reporter in Stockton, and crack was just everywhere. It was inescapable because it was very public. Drive-by shootings, bullets whizzing through parking apartment complexes. The reaction, though, is what you're talking about, and the reaction was to impose very, very strict punishment, prison sentences and whatnot, for crack, federally certainly, and a lot of emphasis was on incarceration and throwing people in jail, and that this was going to be the solution, and there was very little attention given at all to treating people's addiction that has led them to this. And so that's what's different. That is, it's radically, radically different. I believe that has a lot to do with the fact that most of the people, almost all the people, I believe this is almost entirely a white phenomenon, a white problem in America. I met no Latinos and only one black person who had been affected by it in my research. Those folks, their parents, their relatives are clamoring for new approaches that were ignored 20, 25 years ago when the crack issue was foremost in the country's mind. We put a lot of money into prisons. We did not put a lot of money into addiction studies, treatment, cure, or just basically recovery treatment at all back then. And I've told a few people at public meetings. They say, you know, the only alternatives for my son are jail and the street. And I said, yeah, and that's what we voted for as a country. We supported that for 25 years, you know, remember? Remember those crack laws? Mm-hmm. You know, way back when, we really, you know, putting people in prison has its place. But you've also you're finding out now why the other component that was completely ignored was not. Now, what's happening now, I find fascinating, is that this is especially causing a coming to Jesus moment among more conservative Republican. People, areas, counties, states, what have you, because those states thought themselves immune from drug addiction. They never really had to deal with it too much. And if it did, it was their black community or something like that. It was a very vague idea, like, this doesn't affect us, you know?
And to that point, Sam, right, to that point, we've got about a minute left. There was a great piece in Take Part, and I understand you're actually writing about this. In Kentucky, heroin overdoses claimed the lives of 233 people in 2014, compared with 22 in 2010. And House Appropriations Committee Chair Hal Rogers, a Republican from Kentucky, says that organizations administering syringe exchange programs at the state and local level are poised to provide much-needed intervention for people struggling with addiction.
Right.
He said that he still opposes the use of federal funds to subsidize illicit drug use, but what a change of heart. I mean, you're writing about this.
He's a perfect example. That's a pretty conservative cat right there, Hal Rogers. And he, from Eastern Kentucky, Appalachia basically, is what he represents. And he's gone through that whole transition with regard to where our dollars ought to be spent, and the reason is he's getting loads of waves of constituents coming to him with, my son's addicted, the high school football player, a star quarterback on our team, business people who can't get people who can pass a drug test, on and on, waves and waves and waves of people. And his change came a lot long ago. I've interviewed Congressman Rogers, and his change on this issue came several years ago. What's happening now in the last 2-3 years is you're seeing a transformation of people in many, many other parts of the country, many of them Republican, many of them in areas that are very, very red, and yet they're now talking no longer that tough on crime thing that worked back in the crack days.
Sam, we definitely want to do a show about this. Sam Quinones is award-winning journalist and former LA Times reporter. His most recent book is Dreamland. Thank you, Sam, for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Professor Leif Winar about his new book, Blood Oil: Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. In spite of major progress and the Leave It in the Ground movement, we're still connected to suffering and injustice through our addiction to oil. So what are the global consequences of our reliance on natural resources? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.